presented. So the first question presented was, does Michigan or any state, are they allowed to ban same-sex marriage? The second question was the recognition question. And that was just a complete bloodbath. We might even get a 9-0 decision on that side.
So define the second question for the audience. What exactly was being asked of the court?
So usually when you get, so for example, if you get married in New Hampshire and you are, then you travel to Massachusetts, then Massachusetts, even though they didn't issue that marriage license, they will still recognize it as a valid marriage. And that is just a rule that has been in place for hundreds of years in America because
right.
people get married in one state and cross borders. And the idea is that under full faith and credit, you have to give those marriages full faith and credit. And that was the case, you know, in previous centuries because, for example, in New York for a long time, Jews couldn't marry Christians under the law. But if you could get married in Rhode Island, you could come back to New York and have your marriage recognized. So the first question is, does Michigan have to issue the license? The second question is, does Michigan have to recognize an out-of-state marriage license? And so that might seem like a really technical detail, but actually, under the law, those are pretty distinct questions.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that go
to the Defense of Marriage Act? Wasn't that what happened under Bill Clinton when they passed the Defense of Marriage Act? Wasn't that a way of being able to sort of create this sort of artificial concept that no, even if gay marriage is recognized in one state, it quote unquote protected those states so they didn't have to recognize that marriage? Wasn't that really what the definition of the Defense of Marriage Act was?
Exactly. That was one of the reasons because in Hawaii at the time there was litigation and the Hawaii Supreme Court suggested that marriage bans might violate the state constitution. And so at that point, DOMA was passed by Congress to prevent people from getting married in Hawaii and then coming back to New Hampshire or Washington or Michigan or wherever and having those marriages recognized. And that was the primary impetus behind the Federal Defense of Marriage Act.
Okay, Nancy.
I have a question. What emotion, if any, did you see on the face of Clarence Thomas? I know he doesn't speak, but
that's good.
I'm real curious because yes, there's a certain history here.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, crossing state lines, getting married and being accepted.
Yeah, yeah.
So was there any emotion on his face?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that was, I think, the surprising thing because I thought, well, Justice Thomas doesn't speak, so therefore he's stoic, and that could not be further from the truth. His facial expressions are just, I mean, he has a very, I mean, he could not be a poker player. He definitely does not hide his emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he is reading most of the time. Like, he'll be reading the briefs, and the Supreme Court has certain assistants who sit behind the dais, and they'll go to the library and pull back case books, and they'll be reading cases while the advocates are speaking. And that's mostly what Thomas is doing. But Justice Thomas, I mean, has a very expressive face. And I think the most expressive I saw him was when the protester got up and sat down. Justice Scalia made a comment along the lines of, oh, well, that was refreshing. And the joke was that, you know, he just interrupted the super boring law process with an act of civil disobedience or whatever. But the joke clearly did not land with the audience and with the justices. And at that point, Justice Thomas put his hands over his face and shook his head like, Justice Scalia, I can't believe you just said that. That was the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Wow.
So Justice Thomas does not have a poker face, even though he doesn't speak.
Thank you for asking that question, Nancy. What about Sotomayor? What was she like on the bench?
Oh, she is a firecracker. I mean, she is incredibly intelligent. And she is the second most junior justice on the court. And the way that it's seated is that the most senior people are in the middle. And as you go out towards the end, then that's where the junior people are. So, of course, Kagan and Sotomayor are the junior people. So they're sitting on the very far right and far left. And, I mean, they just boxed in the advocates. I mean, when they were attacking the conservatives, I mean, it was just like he would turn all the way to one side to address Sotomayor, and then he'd have to turn almost 180 degrees and talk to Justice Kagan. And, I mean, it was clearly unsettling to them, but it was very satisfying to watch.
I heard something that maybe you can sort of refresh my recollection. I thought I understood. Was it Sotomayor who spoke for so long that at one point Justice Roberts had to turn to the attorney and say, well, since you haven't gotten one chance to say one word, I'm going to give you an extra 5 minutes. Was it Sotomayor that was the one that was kind of like the you know, the battling ram? I'm trying to figure out which one it was.
She definitely spoke for a long time, but her questions are very short. I mean, her style is short questions, but a lot of questions. And Justice Scalia and Justice Kagan are the justices with sort of longer questions. And that's, I think it was one of those justices that Chief Justice Roberts interrupted and said, oh, maybe we should give the advocate a chance to respond. But I don't remember who it was.
Okay, so we're talking with Wyatt Foer. He is a third-year law student at the University of Michigan. He was able to sit in on the Supreme Court case, the number of cases dealing with gay marriage and the recognition of gay marriage. And the question will be, obviously, at the end of the Supreme Court term, will marriage be recognized and permitted in all 50 states? And it's a really incredible opportunity that Wyatt had. So Wyatt, you mentioned that it was very conversational, but you also said it was conversational between the judges. So how did the judges interact between each other? I mean, I always assumed that the focus would be just on the lawyers, and really not between the justices. So give me an example of an interaction between the judges on the bench.
Well, so the justices, I think at one point back in Supreme Court history, oral argument was used to actually ask real questions and sort of figure out the law. But this contemporary Supreme Court seems to use oral arguments much more as an opportunity to discuss their concerns with each other. And so, for example, Justice Scalia and Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan and Chief Justice Roberts sort of had this four-person conversation. I think it was with Barry or with Bursch. I don't recall, but I mean, they are basically speaking to each other. And I think the most memorable point in this was Justice Scalia was really pushing Mary Bonanno on the religious freedom question, namely that if the court intervenes and strikes down these marriage bans, are ministers going to be required to marry couples of the same sex? And so Justice Scalia just will not let this go. He talks about this for about 10 minutes, Mary saying, no, of course, you know, we have the First Amendment, we have freedom of religion. Nobody is saying that ministers have to marry couples they don't want to. And Justice Kagan intervenes and says, oh, well, counselor, isn't it the case that a lot of rabbis won't do official weddings where with one Jewish partner and one non-Jewish partner? And doesn't that show how current marriage law already protects religious freedom, and that Justice Scalia's question is actually a non sequitur? And so, I mean, that, and Mary just replies back, well, yes, Your Honor, I think that is the case.
Justice Kagan. I needed that. You can just, you can almost see the smile, like, wow, that was a wonderful example. And that was that I think what really gets me upset, and I think you mentioned that Scalia sort of wants to sort of hold on to this sort of religious argument that turns out to be a fiction, is that in a way it just continues to play to the fear. Because just imagine on social media, they'll be quoting Justice Scalia. Here he is, a United States Supreme Court justice, making these assertions when, as Kagan points out, it ain't true. But nobody gets to hear what Wyatt got to hear, which was the whole argument, with Kagan basically saying, you're wrong, Justice Scalia, but you've got Justice Scalia on the record saying stuff that's patently false. It just really irritates me that he does it, I think knowing full well that what he's saying is inaccurate.
And he's protected for life.
Yeah, and he's protected for life. All right, so we're going to have to get sort of close to the point of wrapping up. So walk me through what happens towards the end. Does a bell go off? Does a ringer go off? Does the judge look at his watch? I'm sort of curious how the whole conversation comes to a halt.
So the advocate stands at the podium, and there's actually a red light. And the rule is that when the red light goes on, you stop talking. Doesn't matter if you're in the middle of the sentence, doesn't matter if you're in the middle of the word, you stop talking. And that's exactly how it happens. So red light goes off, there's not a buzz or anything. Advocate shuts up, sits down, and the next person just immediately stops talking. And when we're done, when all five advocates were finished, basically the Chief Justice hits the gavel and says, case submitted, and then everyone rises and then leaves. I mean, it's very, there wasn't a pomp and circumstance to everyone leaving except for the gavel, everyone leaving, and then the justices sort of get behind the red velvet curtain again, and then it's all over. And then, you know, you leave the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, the entrance is in the basement, but the exit is at the top of those beautiful stairs, those beautiful golden doors. And so when you're leaving, you actually walk down the stairs, and you can just see, you know, 1,000 people or whatever on the public sidewalk and across the street protesting and all chanting, and people are doing press conferences and all that kind of stuff. And there's about 500 feet between you and where the crowd starts, and just walking down the stairs, I mean, it was unlike anything I've ever seen before. It was just amazing.
So you talked about the fact that, you know, over those last, you know, couple of days before the hearing, when you were out online in these sort of shanties that you had sort of created with tarps and chairs, that you really had created a sense of community. So take that to the leaving. So you're leaving after these amazing arguments. You get to hear some of the smartest people on the planet having a conversation in front of you. And in a way, I'm kind of grateful that the Supreme Court justices are, in fact, talking to each other, because we are never privileged to hear how they get to a decision. But at least, if nothing else, we can hear the banter that they do in public, because otherwise they really are under wraps all the time. So there is, I think, a value for hearing this. But so the court closes, and then you leave. Did you continue to have any conversation with any of that line community as you were leaving? And I know that those kids were basically, for example, the Mormon kids were holding a place for the elders. Did you get a chance to regroup with them? Did you see them afterwards? I would love to sort of have like almost a denouement on what happened with the hearing.
Oh, well, sadly, the kids got out of line. The elders came in line. So, you know, we talked to the elders for probably about an hour before the beginning, but the relationship was just not the same because, again, they hadn't experienced the 4 days of getting rained on and sleeping outside. The kids, unfortunately, went home and went to go back to sleep, so we didn't get to see them. But there were probably about a group of 15 or 20 of us who all became pretty good friends, and we all went out to drinks that night and went out to dinner, and we just had a really, really excellent night. And I've actually been texting them all this morning, and we've created a Facebook group because we're all going to try to go down and visit the Supreme Court when they actually announce the opinion. So we definitely, the community is certainly continuing, but unfortunately we haven't been able to find the kids yet.
So I asked Gilles Bissonnet, who is the attorney for the Civil Liberties Union in New Hampshire, and we both came to the conclusion that the court has to read what's happening in the world around them. I mean, as Gilles said, he said, if anyone had told me like 20 years ago where we would be, you know, on Tuesday before the Supreme Court with 36 states having recognized gay marriage, he said, I would have thought that was impossible. And yet, look where we are. And the court has to be aware of the changing of public opinion. The court has to be aware that it's also a change, even among a demographic, that anyone under the age of 35 kind of looks and says, what's the problem? And even people who are older are beginning to change. And I'll give you an example. Why my father, you know, homophobic as he was, at one point he was asking me about his oldest granddaughter. And he said to me, has she met anyone? And I said, I don't know, Dad. And he says, I want her to be in love. I don't care if it's a boy or a girl. And Wyatt, I started to cry because my dad is this homophobic old man, and yet he so loved his granddaughter, he just wanted her to be loved. And that tells me that even when we think that people over a certain age are not prepared to embrace things, I think we're wrong. Because I think as we see more and more people sort of sharing who they are and letting people know that they're your sons and daughters and nieces and nephews, I think even the statistics or the polling data is not as accurate as what's in people's heads and hearts.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, even just here in Michigan, you can just see a sea change in the last 3 years that I've been in law school. You know, when I first came here, the idea that, you know, we would have this sort of nation, we're on the verge of nationwide marriage equality. I mean, that just seemed almost, that seemed like a crazy opinion distant in the future. And even just in 3 years, things have just changed so much. And I'm really excited to see where the next 10 years take us. But I think that that's what's so central about the democratic process in America, is that there is something inherent in human nature where there's this fear of the outsider, the fear of the other. But the other side is also true, that there's also this strong impulse in human nature to create community and to recognize our differences and to come together. And I think that that's what democracy is about, and that's what constitutional democracy is about. And it's very exciting to see the process work right in front of our eyes.
Well, we're going to be talking with some folks, obviously, about the presidential campaigns that are erupting everywhere, you know, 19 or 20 candidates on one side, only two so far on the Democratic side. But it's going to be really fascinating to watch how the Republican candidates do the dance with this issue. Because for them, it is the challenge. You know, they're so afraid of their evangelical base. And at the same time, they also, I think, recognize that their embrace of discrimination makes no sense. And so it's going to be,
totally agree.
It's going to be a very, very interesting year. And I'm so glad that I live in the state of New Hampshire, because I get a front row seat like Wyatt did in the Supreme Court to sort of see how these candidates deal with this very important issue. Wyatt, good luck with your exams. You'll make a fabulous lawyer, and come back and visit us in New Hampshire.
Sounds great. Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, ciao. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Nancy Greenwood sitting in for Susan Bruce. Look at how intimate we were this time. What a great story. Ciao, everyone.
Because when you can't find a friend, you still got the radio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 7 o'clock. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Improvisation Summit of Portland, June 4th through 6th at Disjecta in Portland. This all-ages event brings together musicians, dancers, and experimental performers for 3 days of improvisational art. Performers include